her dead the next morning. 10 days later, O-6 was leading the brothers through Lamar Canyon, the narrow gorge that connected Little America and the Lamar Valley, when she came across White Line once again. This time the druid female was alone. Uncowed by their recent clash, she had been tailing O-6 for days, still holding out hope she could win the two males back. As the highest-ranking druid female, she would have been 755's mate had she been able to hold on to him. Now, as the brothers looked on, O-6 squared off with White Line for a second time. The brothers made no move to join in as their leader attacked, but she didn't need their help. O-6 lunged again and again as White Line, weakened by months of poor feeding, struggled to fend her off. She was losing badly but refused to retreat. Suddenly she buckled under her attacker, exposing her flank, and O-6 sank her inch-long canines deep into her opponent's leg. Moments later, White Line, bleeding profusely, simply stopped fighting. As if by some unspoken agreement, O-6 sensed the contest was over too, and stood and watched as her defeated opponent limped off into the woods alone, looking for a suitable place to die. The park road ran right through Lamar Canyon, and a dozen people had been standing near their cars in a pullout when O-6 attacked White Line. Through their scopes, they watched the battle in the trees on the side of the canyon above them, until the warring parties eventually went their separate ways. While the watchers were still marveling at what they had just witnessed, a bull elk appeared above the parking area, halfway up the partially wooded side of the canyon, running full out with O-6 and the two males just behind. Scopes were frantically swung back and forth as the action appeared and disappeared through the gaps in the trees. Then the watchers lost sight of both predators and prey, and the chase seemed to be over. Then the bull reappeared. He turned unexpectedly downhill, ran clear of the pines, and barreled straight toward the startled watchers at the roadside. 5 feet tall at the shoulder, with an enormous spread of antlers, he was in full flight, panicked and heedless of his surroundings. O-6 was on him again, by herself now, closing the gap in the snow. He veered away from the pavement at the last moment and began running parallel to the road. The watchers had no need for scopes now. The chase was unfolding only a stone's throw away. O-6 ran right by the lot without a glance at her audience, oblivious to anything but the fleeing bull. These were the moments the most dedicated watchers lived for. The excitement that made the zero-degree mornings, the long, cold waits along the roadside in the wind or the driving snow, even the days without a single sighting, all worthwhile. O-6 reached the bull's heels, close enough to make contact. The elk wheeled and crossed the road, and O-6 suddenly broke off the pursuit. She'd gotten her teeth into his hide in a few places, but not enough to slow him down. The bull was big, with plenty of vigor, even this late in winter. If she'd had the two males with her, the trio might have brought him down within 200 yards of the parking lot, with everyone watching. But the males hadn't been able to keep up with the action, or perhaps quailed when the chase veered toward the road, and had lost track of O-6 and her quarry somewhere in the trees above. The watchers could hear them howling for her as she slowly made her way back in their direction. It was more than sheer luck that landed so many watchers in just the right place to catch the stunning action that morning. Spread out along the northern range was a small group of aficionados with whom Rick kept in constant radio contact throughout the day, a wolf-spotting network that park biologists and professional guides called Rick Radio, and had come to rely on themselves. Chief among the spotters was a 58-year-old retired school teacher from San Diego named Lori Lyman, who lived within shouting distance of Rick's cabin in Silvergate. Lori had caught the wolf bug in the late 1990s after observing wolves raised in captivity by a documentary filmmaker in northern Idaho. Fascinated by the complexity of their social interactions, she devoured every wolf-related film or book she could find, and in time almost every piece of art in her third-grade classroom was wolf-themed. Lori began visiting Yellowstone whenever she could get away. When she retired in 2006, she bought a beautiful two-story log house on the edge of Silvergate. Her husband, also a retired school teacher, joined her when he could, but she spent most of her time these days with Rick and a small community of dedicated wolf watchers from across the country, each of whom lived for the few weeks or months they spent in Yellowstone every year, hauling their scopes from one pullout to another, hoping to see something wonderful. It was an eclectic group. Many of them were retired, like Sean Jones, a plain-spoken former police detective from England, who made the long flight to the park every winter. Kathy Lynch, a biology teacher from Northern California, and Marlene Ford, who taught special education in Salt Lake City, were among the many educators who became regulars, taking advantage of long summer and winter breaks. Ford was in her early 30s and hadn't missed a summer in the park since reintroduction. She drove a Toyota SUV with an enormous decal on the hood depicting a polar bear nosing through a pile of garbage above the words, "I'd rather be eating seals." The youngest regular was Jeremy Sunderraj, whose parents started bringing him to the park when he was 6. On one of his first visits, he watched as a pack of wolves defending their den separated 2 grizzly cubs from their mother and killed them both. He was hooked. Now a teenager, his plan was to study wildlife biology in college. He was working in Silvergate so he could spend the entire summer in the park, shadowing Rick as he made his rounds every morning. In between visits, the watchers kept in touch with one another on Facebook and stayed abreast of the latest developments on blogs dedicated to wolves or news from Yellowstone. Lori stood barely 5 feet tall, but she had a big personality, by turns assertive and motherly, and she gradually became the hub of the community. She and Rick compared notes on the phone almost every night, and Lori chronicled what she and her friends had seen in an email she sent out daily to all her wolf-watching contacts. Eventually, her updates became so popular that Nathan Varley, a biologist who ran one of the park's most successful wolf-watching guide services, hired her to post them to his website, where hundreds of subscribers around the country could read them every night. In 2007, Lori and Rick were joined in Silvergate by another die-hard wolf lover named Doug McLaughlin, who ran a boarding service for thoroughbred horses in rural Washington State. That winter, a friend volunteering in Yellowstone had called Doug, who was then 60 and unmarried, to ask if he might be able to fill in for 2 weeks. He fell into a routine of daily wolf-watching and quickly got to know the regulars in the Lamar Valley, along with their lexicon. The watchers had a name for every pullout along the park road, for landmarks not found on any map, a kind of shorthand almost indecipherable to the uninitiated. He was mesmerized by the magic of Yellowstone, the crystal-clear lakes, the mountains, the endless forests of pine and Douglas fir, and above all, the wolves themselves. After a week, he called his 3 adult daughters back home in Washington and told them he wasn't sure when he was coming back. By spring, he had sold his business and moved to Silvergate, where he found a job managing resort cabins. He had spent nearly every morning since in the park, watching wolves. Doug found he had a knack with a spotting scope and became so adept that he quickly emerged as Rick's most valuable spotter. He held the informal record among the watchers for the most distant sighting, 11 miles. He once pinpointed a pack moving through tall weeds from over a mile away by the pollen cloud billowing above them as they trotted along. Tall and lanky, with a quick laugh and an avuncular disposition, Doug was also a natural salesman. As he became a regular among the watchers, he began selling spotting scopes to visitors from the back of his truck. Nothing compared to the solitude of a crisp, cold Yellowstone morning. And yet wolf watching was a social experience, too. It was all about enjoying the camaraderie of your fellow watchers, with their shared thermoses of hot coffee and stories about grandchildren or home renovations or football or whatever they could think of to pass the time. You had to cultivate a zen-like patience and trust that the sighting would come somewhere in the park, at some time, before the sun went down and it was time to go back to the cabin or the campsite. Just finding the wolves in the vastness of the park could be an extremely difficult task. Rick's telemetry readings indicated only the general direction and distance at which a collared wolf might be found, and sometimes even that information was unreliable. Especially here in Yellowstone's craggy northern range, the signals from collared wolves emanating from one direction had an annoying habit of bouncing off the sides of opposing bluffs, such that watchers might spend an entire morning scoping the wrong side of a valley. A bevy of circling ravens might mean wolves on a carcass somewhere nearby, or it might mean nothing at all. A promising signal might be a wolf approaching. Or it could be a pack moving away, not to return for hours and hours. There was a lot of standing around, endlessly scanning with scopes set to lowest magnification, listening for howling, fruitlessly checking the radio for reports from the next pullout, and, especially on the coldest days, retreating to the warmth of the car when your fingers or toes became too numb. Experiencing Yellowstone through a spotting scope was an entirely different experience from seeing the park from a car or even from a hiking trail. Only when you tried scanning the entire length of Specimen Ridge or Druid Peak, one 200-yard diameter circle at a time, did you get a sense of how big the Lamar Valley really was. Every contour of the land seen with the naked eye from the roadside was really several such folds, each with a dale in between, sometimes visible and sometimes hidden. And each of those dales held countless features of its own. Boulder gardens, narrow creek-filled drainages, meadows bound by copses of aspen or fir or lodgepole pine, where a wildlife drama might unfold. You'd follow a creek upstream from the valley floor until its bed became a swale, which in turn became an enormous drainage, big enough to spend an hour exploring through your scope. Then you'd pull your eye away and realize that this miniature landscape you'd just begun to study was only one tiny portion of a vast mountainside. And beyond that was another valley and another mountain, and so on for miles and miles. The fact that wolves were seen at all in Yellowstone was the real miracle. In his 1944 monograph, The Wolves of Mount McKinley, Adolf Murie described the inexhaustible thrill of watching wolves, though he conceded somewhat dryly that not every minute of every hour was thrilling. "Many hours were spent watching the wolves at the den," he wrote, "and yet when I undertake to write about it, there does not seem to be a great deal to relate, certainly not an amount commensurate with the time spent observing these animals." That didn't deter Rick. Wolves tended to run through the night and rest most of the day, and the truth was that he had spent a considerable portion of the last 30 years of his life watching wolves sleep. In recent years he had begun taking a midday nap himself, since there wasn't much to see in the afternoons anyway. On most evenings he'd come back out before the sun went down, when the wolves roused themselves for a night of hunting. Between sightings, the watchers spent much of their time enjoying other species. When wolves were scarce, for example, grizzlies could usually be counted on for a good show, beating the bushes for pronghorn fawns or elk calves every spring, or gorging on berries in the summertime. In time, a dedicated watcher came to know every likely nesting area for eagles and osprey, the carefully hidden locations of coyote dens, the ponds that hosted the park's scattering of beaver colonies, the places where river otters liked to play. And then there were the great herds of elk, pronghorn, and buffalo, the animals that inspired Congress to make Yellowstone the world's first national park. The Lamar Valley boasted the highest prey density of any place on Earth outside the African Serengeti. The playful bison calves, called red dogs for their ruddy fur, cavorting in the spring were a favorite, though the watchers also had to be leery of the bulls in mating season, when surging hormones made them unpredictable and dangerous. Inevitably, they spent a lot of time watching elk, just as the wolves did. It wasn't a bad strategy. Wherever there were elk grazing, there was the possibility of a predator sighting, too. As splendid as the elk were, wolf watchers who had been in the field long enough invariably adopted a kind of morbid humor about their role in the food chain, and the unfortunate but inescapable fact that elk were essentially bait for the animals they were all hoping to see. "Aren't they beautiful?" Doug had been known to comment when he had winter-weakened elk in his scope and no visitors were around. "Maybe if we're lucky, one of them will die." Setting up in the darkness every morning, spending countless hours chatting by the roadside, checking in by radio, Rick, Laurie, and Doug became friends. It often fell to the three of them to come up with names for uncollared wolves so that one could be told from another. It was Laurie who had named O6 after she found herself spending so much time chronicling the audacious female's behavior. Rick and Laurie and Doug. Between them, they knew more about the wolves of the Northern Range than even the Wolf Project biologists. The professionals recorded their subjects' ages and weights, their ranges and diets, their fertility and longevity. But the watchers knew their stories. Laurie wrote up the battle between O6 and Whiteline and the chase of the renegade bull in her update the night of February 20th, 2010. And suddenly O6 and her exploits were all the far-flung community of Yellowstone wolf watchers were talking about. There was a new star to follow in the Northern Range. A few days later, Whiteline's carcass was spotted on a wooded ridge not far from Lamar Canyon. Rick volunteered to hike up and remove her remains so the project biologists could examine her. When he reached her, he found that her carcass had been extensively scavenged over the preceding days. Wolves didn't eat other wolves. The most likely culprit was a mountain lion that had been spotted recently in the canyon. Carrying Whiteline's remains down to the valley floor, Rick couldn't help but think of the death of 21, the druid alpha male he had loved so much. Now, nearly 6 years after 21's death, he was bringing another dead druid alpha down the mountain. Whiteline's demise made a difficult truth impossible to ignore. The saga of the druids, the story of 21 and his descendants, was now all but over. And it wasn't just the druid story that had turned sour. Things had taken a bad turn for Yellowstone wolves in general. If 21 was the star of the Wolf Project's first decade, the truth was that in the years since his death, the show wasn't quite what it used to be. Dozens of Yellowstone wolves had been lost in recent years to mange and other canine diseases. As the park's surplus population of elk leveled off in response to renewed predation, meanwhile, the wolf population had begun to do the same. From a high of 174 wolves just 7 years before, the number of wolves had plummeted to roughly 100. Project biologists had long suspected that such a drop would occur as a kind of equilibrium was reached between predators and available prey, but it was still hard for veteran watchers to accept. Wolves were now harder to spot than they had been in years, and Rick resigned himself to the inevitability of an occasional day without a sighting. Outside the park, meanwhile, another profound change had taken place. As Rick and his friends watched O6 chase elk across Little America, wolves themselves were being legally hunted for the first time in modern memory. After years of courthouse wrangling, the management of wolves had at last been returned to state control in both Montana and Idaho, though Wyoming's bid to open its first wolf hunting season was tied up in litigation. Yellowstone wolves were still protected as long as they stayed in the park, where hunting was never allowed. But as soon as they left the park's northern and western borders, they entered woods filled with hunters and were now fair game. Wolf advocates had fought against this day for years, filing lawsuit after lawsuit to keep wolves on the endangered species list. As employees of the National Park Service, Doug Smith and his fellow Wolf Project members were bound to support the decision made by their colleagues at U.S. Fish and Wildlife to declare the species officially recovered in the Northern Rockies. Unofficially, Smith had long feared losing federal protection, or delisting, since it would inevitably mean the deaths of wolves his team had followed for years. It wasn't that Smith believed his wolves were sacred. In fact, almost every year since reintroduction, he had reluctantly approved the shooting of a handful of Yellowstone wolves who had attacked livestock grazing near the park. Such culling wouldn't normally have been allowed under the Endangered Species Act, but a special concession had been made to ranchers in the original reintroduction plan. Any reintroduced wolves who preyed on livestock would be shot. The wolves' overall impact on ranching hadn't been severe. Around 200 cattle, out of roughly 5 million across Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming, were lost to predation in an average year. By comparison, tens of thousands of cattle were killed every year by winter storms, lightning, floods, or drought. But some individual operations near the core reintroduction areas were hit hard, and a promise was a promise. In the spring of 2002, Carter Niemeyer found himself face to face with the reality of what that promise meant. After central Idaho's White Hawk Pack encountered cattle grazing in the Sawtooth National Forest, they began taking livestock on a regular basis, eventually settling near a fenced pasture owned by a local rancher. Government trappers killed several pack members, but still the depredations continued. Niemeyer tried every technique he could think of to drive the remaining wolves off, including installing specially modified speakers along fence lines, rigged to respond to the presence of radio signals emitted by the wolves' research collars. The speakers blasted the sounds of civilization, gunfire, human voices, car engines, at any collared wolf that came near. Volunteers even camped near the pastures to ensure a constant human presence between the livestock and the wolves. Nothing seemed to work. Finally, one morning in April, Niemeyer found himself climbing into a helicopter with a 12-gauge shotgun, heading out to hunt down the descendants of the very same wolves he had personally brought down from Canada just 7 years before. Niemeyer had hoped the day would never come, but he wasn't the type to delegate unpleasant tasks to other people. Over the next 5 hours, the pilot buzzed the panicked pack as Niemeyer methodically shot every remaining member. It was among the worst days of his life, but if this was the price of having wolves running free in the Northern Rockies again, he was willing to pay it. At least White Line had died the way a wolf was meant to, Rick thought, defending her territory and trying to provide for her family. If the Druid saga really was over, it was equally true that 06 had helped bring the story to a close. And yet Rick supposed that 06 was a Druid herself, in a sense. Her mother had been born in the den on Druid Peak, after all, and maybe that gave 06 as good a claim on the valley as White Line or any other wolf in Yellowstone. There was something undeniably remarkable about her. If she had pups of her own and stayed in the northern range, near the road, the rise of her clan might be a story worth following, too. Even though she had come out on top in her contest with White Line, her odds of survival were not all that good. She was an amazing hunter, a once-in-a-generation hunter. But after she'd denned, she'd be unable to get food for herself. Her two new running mates would have to do the heavy lifting, and their abilities were far from proven. If they couldn't deliver, the pups might not survive. and 06 might not either, for that matter. But Rick believed she would make it. Druid blood was special. Chapter 4 Killers. Stephen Turnbull parked his truck in front of the Painter Outpost, Crandall's only store, and restaurant and bar, and stepped out onto the flattened snow in the unpaved parking lot. It was a Monday afternoon in late March 2010, which meant the bar would be full, or as full as it ever got. Mail was delivered to Crandall from the post office in Cody on Mondays and Thursdays, and people up and down the valley drove in around 4 p.m. to collect their junk mail and bills at the small bank of post office boxes near the store. Afterward, a handful of regulars would come inside for a beer. Crandall wasn't really a town, so its residents had no city hall or library or school or public park, no real center of gravity to gather around. What they had was the store, and sooner or later everyone ended up there. You could pick up a fishing license, along with toilet paper, milk, a few groceries, beer, and the latest gossip. The Clark's Fork ran behind the store, and beyond loomed Hunter Peak, still dusted with snow, though it was greening up a bit. Across the valley, massive Table Mountain was also beginning to show signs of spring, which meant they would soon be opening the road to Yellowstone. Beautiful as it was, the park had nothing that compared to Crandall's stunning vistas of the heart of the Absarokas. But they were cruel mountains. You took your chances traveling through Crandall, especially in winter. Tall poles marked the sides of the snow-covered road, which all but disappeared between plowings. Turnbull had pulled more than a few neighbors out of the ditch with his pickup over the years. Occasionally, somebody went over the high side on one of the slippery switchbacks and rolled down the mountainside, where they were beyond anybody's help. The barroom at the outpost had four or five stools and a few tables, with pine wainscoting running down a back wall covered with beer signs. It was neat and clean and relatively new. The original store had been destroyed in the great 1988 fire that burned nearly half of Yellowstone before sweeping down into Crandall and sending everyone scrambling for their lives. Turnbull spotted Louis Carey at the bar, holding court as usual. Crandall didn't have a mayor, but Louis was the closest thing to it. He was a small man with narrow cheeks, kind blue eyes, and a thick shock of gray hair, which he habitually combed forward with his fingernails when he was deep in conversation and a word wouldn't come to him. Louis and his wife Shelley ran a guest ranch and hunting outfitting service in the shadow of Hunter Peak, about a half mile up the Clark's Fork from the store, which his family had once owned as well. His grandfather bought the ranch in 1939 to run cattle, and his mother and father converted the property in the 1950s, renovating an old log building raised by one of the valley's original homesteaders, and gradually adding cabins and a rustic two-story lodge with a dozen cozy rooms. For decades, the Carey family had maintained a pair of hunting camps along Crandall Creek. One high up near the headwaters, not too far from the national park boundary, and another lower down. They took clients into the backcountry all fall and winter for a week at a time, heading up the mountain with a string of horses carrying cooks, guides, and horse wranglers. Louis grew up wrangling horses for the crew, and later guiding hunts himself. At the camps were tents for everyone and a makeshift kitchen. At dawn, Louis and his dad led the hunters into the timber around the camp in search of an elk. If a client managed to bring one down, Louis dressed it on the spot, gutting and quartering the huge beast and lugging the meat back down the mountain to be cut up and put on ice. The trophy went to the taxidermist. Outfitting hunters had long been among the most reliable trades in Crandall and the neighboring basin to the east known as Sunlight. Turnbull's uncle Wayne had been a guide there for years. Like all of Crandall's outfitters, the Careys catered to out-of-town hunters those who needed someone to help them find an elk. The area was widely known as one of the best elk hunting spots in Wyoming, if not the nation, and clients came from all over the country. Some had saved up for the opportunity of a lifetime, but most were well-heeled. The going rate for a guided elk hunt was $5,000. In the old days, there had been so many elk up Crandall Creek that clients almost never came back without a quality bull trophy. Louis's dad would put out some salt not far from the camp to encourage the elk, usually a bull and his harem of cows, to gather and linger. Then one of the guides would mimic the warbling mating call of another male, bugling, as it was known, to draw the bull away from the harem, and the client would be invited to take his shot. After a day or two, another bull would find the harem, and the guides would repeat the process for the next client. Rarely did they have to go into the heavy timber to get a bull. The guides would simply set up on an open ridge with the call and wait for the bull to come out. It was a good way to make a living, and at one time there were 9 or 10 outfitters working in Crandall and Sunlight. Louis's only son grew up wrangling and guiding, just as he had. Turnbull enjoyed Louis's stories about the old days, though he was careful not to get him started on the Nez Perce, who famously trekked through the Absarokas in the fall of 1877 with the U.S. cavalry in hot pursuit, unless he had a solid hour to spare. These days, talk at the store inevitably came around to wolves. Louis was among the first in Crandall to spot a wolf wandering over from Yellowstone, and his initial impression was not a positive one. It was the winter of 1997, and he was up Crandall Creek with a couple of clients on an elk hunt. One of them had just shot a bull, and Louis was about to begin field dressing him. In the meantime, he told the hunters to head up over the next ridge, where he thought he'd seen a second bull. They returned almost immediately, gushing with excitement. They'd seen a wolf, a big black male, just up the trail. "Whatever you do, don't shoot it," Louis thought. He didn't need that kind of trouble. But somebody already had. When Louis picked up the wolf's trail in the snow, he could see that he was limping badly and trailing blood. As the trio made their way down the mountain on horseback, he spotted the injured wolf from time to time through the trees. When Louis got back to the lodge, he heard the news. 2 collared Yellowstone wolves had been illegally shot that morning, a pair of males from the park's Druid Peak pack. One was dead already. The black he had spotted in the backcountry, the pack's alpha male, it turned out, was now holed up in a gorge on Hoodoo Creek. Officials from Fish and Wildlife had already called the lodge, looking for the guilty party. Louis had a pretty good idea who might have pulled the trigger, but it wasn't one of his clients, and he kept his mouth shut. The stakes were high. Everybody in Crandall had heard the story of Chad McKittrick, the hellraiser up in Red Lodge who had gone to jail for shooting a Yellowstone wolf. "Shoot, shovel, and shut up," was a mantra you often heard east of the park, but McKittrick seemed to have forgotten the last part, blabbing to whoever would listen about what he'd done. This time, nobody seemed to be talking. Weeks later, Louis got a call from the clients who were back home in Nebraska. It seemed that Fish and Wildlife wanted to ask them some questions, too. Would they have to come back to Wyoming to testify, they wanted to know, just because a wolf got shot? Louis couldn't guarantee they wouldn't. Fish and Wildlife never came right out and accused Louis or one of his clients of shooting the wolves, but he wasn't especially cooperative with the investigators, and he was on their bad side for a long time. Trouble with the federal government was something he didn't need. His hunting camps were on national forest land, a privilege for which he paid an annual fee, and Fish and Wildlife issued his big game outfitter's license. Doing business with the government meant keeping track of 1,000,000 rules. You had to have the proper amount of the proper kind of insurance. You had to use your camps a certain number of days every winter or risk losing them. And the regulations always seemed to be changing. Yellowstone was even worse. He and his friends called it the Iron Curtain because of all the rules in the park, which fish you could keep, which you had to release, which lures you could use, what kind of hook, and the zeal with which they were enforced. It was against the rules even to drive through the park with harvested game in the back of your truck unless it was covered. Visitors didn't want to see dead elk. Louis had been fighting the government over wolves for a long time. In the early 1990s, he'd represented Crandall on an ad hoc committee formed to oppose wolf reintroduction. Every elk killed by wolves in the summer in Yellowstone, they knew, was one fewer that would be coming down into Crandall in the winter. They'd found a video of wolves demolishing a dairy cow and sent it to a couple of dozen members of Congress. He wondered how many of them had had the stomach to watch the whole thing. Louis had never lost an animal to a wolf, but he'd seen the aftermath on other people's ranches. Calves so thoroughly shredded that they looked like they'd swallowed dynamite, the snow covered in blood. Wolves and sheep were a particularly disastrous combination. Stripped of their natural defenses against predators after centuries of domestication, sheep were known for making no attempt to escape when wolves came calling, and the result could be widespread carnage. Louis and his fellow committee members had made the best case they could. They had even hired a lobbyist. But it all came to nothing. Most of the land in the Northern Rockies belonged to the federal government, and the feds were going to do what the feds were going to do. The result hadn't surprised anyone. Every year since reintroduction, they'd seen more wolves and fewer elk, as Louis had known they would. In the last count taken before wolves were reintroduced in 1995, over 19,000 elk were roaming Yellowstone's northern range. By 2010, that number had plummeted to 6,000, roughly what it had been back in the 1960s, before rangers stopped culling the park's herds. Game officials in Montana and Wyoming insisted the drop wasn't entirely due to wolves. Some of the decline was caused by increased hunting in Montana prior to reintroduction, where state biologists had become alarmed at the size of the herd and the amount of damage the elk were doing to the habitat. Regulators had upped the take by extending the elk season and issuing more permits, both popular decisions at the time. A stubborn drought had also taken its toll, they said, as had habitat lost to development. Though still sparsely populated, the greater Yellowstone area had become one of the fastest-growing regions in the country. Still, you couldn't deny the impact of the wolves. The problem wasn't just that there were fewer elk. The ones that remained were harder to kill. Prior to reintroduction, generation after generation of elk had lived an essentially predator-free existence, outside the fall hunting season. They had gradually begun to act less and less like wild animals and more like cattle, congregating in large numbers in exposed valleys, moving wherever the forage was best, and feeding at their leisure. Now, after 15 years of being chased by wolves, the elk in Crandall were much warier. They tended to spend more time in the trees at higher elevations. They were less likely to gather in large numbers. Local hunters like Turnbull, who had time to spend in the woods, could still get one, if they had the patience and the backcountry skills. Weekend warriors had less luck. As the elk numbers in Crandall came down, the Wyoming Game and Fish Department issued fewer and fewer licenses, until finally there were no more than 20 for non-resident hunters in any given season. Between the guides, the cooks, the wranglers, the horses, the insurance, and the fees, it cost around $25,000 per year to run a camp. With 9 outfitters splitting 20 clients, nobody was making any money, and one by one they closed up shop. These days there were just 3 working operations. As a business, big game hunting was all but dead in Crandall, and it wasn't coming back. Turnbull felt bad for the outfitters who'd gone out of business, though the truth was that he'd also come to resent them a bit, or at least the clients they brought in. In 2003, a popular magazine had listed Crandall and Sunlight among the state's top elk-hunting spots, and ever since then, the number of out-of-towners seeking permits there had climbed steadily, all while elk numbers continued to drop. Setting aside a certain number of tags every year for hunters from out of state didn't help Turnbull's odds in the annual lottery. The locals complained about the number of non-resident hunters, but Wyoming Game and Fish could charge 10 times more for out-of-state permits. Like most state game agencies, the lion's share of the department's budget came from fees paid by hunters and fishermen, so the incentive to keep them coming in was considerable. Turnbull had never failed to draw a tag, but his friends had occasionally come up empty. He knew it was just a matter of time before he was shut out, too. Turnbull hadn't lost his living to the wolves, but he felt like he had lost something else, something harder to define. Crandall without elk just wasn't Crandall. He had once been one of those hunters who shot the elk closest to the road every season, but now he liked to get out into the woods, to stalk animals, to make a study of their habits. He hunted sometimes with friends or his Uncle Wayne, but more often alone, which he preferred. He was a dawn means dawn kind of hunter, and not many of his friends were as serious as he was. He had been that way for a long time. In high school, he once stood up his homecoming date to go hunting with friends. Now he was divorced, with an ex-wife and an adult daughter who lived in rural British Columbia. He had been seeing the same woman for 19 years, though they had never married. She hunted too, though not like he did. Turnbull was what some people might call downwardly mobile. He'd been a trucker, then cashed out and bought a gas station in Cody, which he'd run for a while, more or less by himself, until the EPA told him he needed to replace his underground gasoline storage tanks. No leak had been detected, but the federal government had embarked on a nationwide program to eliminate groundwater contamination by forcing gas stations to upgrade their tanks. It was going to cost $160,000 to dig out the old ones and install replacements. With the slim margins he earned on the station, he'd never repay the loan, so he walked away. Later, he'd owned some pool tables and jukeboxes, which he placed in bars around Cody. He'd spent his share of time replacing felt and tinkering with finicky gadgets. That endeavor had started to go south when new internet-connected jukeboxes became popular. They were more expensive and brought in less money, but customers liked them, so the bars wanted them too. He hadn't been sorry to see that venture come to an end. It was keeping him in town too much, away from the cabin, away from the woods, away from the hunt. Now he never left Crandall if he could help it, aside from a monthly trip to the Walmart in Cody for groceries, and the odd jobs he found left him mostly free to do what he loved. In the rest of America, hunting was dying. Rates of participation had been declining for decades. Only 6% of Americans still hunted. But in the Northern Rockies, it remained integral to the culture. Montana had the highest number of hunters per capita, and Wyoming wasn't far behind. Women hunted, kids hunted, even wildlife biologists hunted. For some, it was less a sport than a means of supplementing the family food budget. Butchering a 500-pound elk yielded upward of 250 pounds of meat for the freezer, enough to last an average family nearly a year, all for the price of a $50 hunting permit. When the Yellowstone elk herd was 19,000 strong, the animals were so plentiful in the woods adjacent to the park that for most subsistence hunters, the driving principle was not fair chase, but convenience. The elk closest to the road, and to the back of the pickup where the carcass had to be lugged, was the right elk. Not every animal shot in the Northern Rockies ended up in a hunter's freezer. Many, if not most, bulls were taken purely for the trophy mount. But enough did that the precipitous decline in elk numbers meant at least some families were buying a lot more hamburger than they used to. Even for those who didn't need the meat or didn't hunt at all, The size and health of the elk herd was a matter of concern, something to talk about at the grocery store or at church, like hay prices or the performance of the local high school football team. The familiar sound of bugling bulls meant another autumn had come. Arches made from elk antler sheds marked the entrance to many mountain towns. Afton, Wyoming, was said to have the world's longest, extending all the way across Highway 89. Elk inspired people. They were a symbol of everything that was special about living here. These days, everything seemed to be conspiring against elk and the people who hunted them. The cattle, for example, competed with elk for the best forage. Cattlemen and hunting guides had made common cause against the wolf, but the truth was that they were far from natural allies. There were maybe 8 or 10 cattle operations in Crandall and Sunlight, almost all of them enormous and well-capitalized. Most of the rangeland was unfenced acreage owned by the National Forest Service, which leased huge sections to cattlemen every summer, just as it had for decades on public lands throughout the northern Rockies. The cattle were brought up into the mountains every spring when the snows melted and acres of lush green grass came back, then were hauled out in mid-October before winter really set in. In the old days, it seemed to Louis, the cattlemen ran their cows higher in the mountains in the spring and summer. They wouldn't bring them down into the valleys alongside the river and the road until the first snows came in September. That meant there was still good forage left in the low-lying areas when the cattle were rounded up and hauled off to their winter range, and the elk started coming down into Crandall from Yellowstone, looking for something to eat. Now the Forest Service let the cattlemen run their cows right along the road all summer, taking the best grass for themselves. With the grass gone, the elk had no reason to linger in Crandall. The outfitters had complained about it, but the cattlemen had more politics, as Louis put it. The ranchers, meanwhile, begrudged the elk for the grass they ate in the summer, especially when the big beasts left national forest land and came onto private ranches to graze on well-watered alfalfa. A tycoon named Earl Holding, the owner of Sinclair Oil, controlled most of the best leases in Crandall and Sunlight. Holding was the richest of the lot, but almost all the ranchers in the area were wealthy, and they weren't afraid to let everybody know it. Louis had seen drivers stop their trucks on the Chief Joseph Highway, unload their cattle right into the road, and then simply drive off, without even shutting anybody's gate, which was the neighborly thing to do. People would step out of their houses in the morning and find a dozen cows in their yard. The smart heifers stayed out of the road, but everyone was expected to drive around the dumb ones. Every now and then a visitor on his way to Yellowstone would plow into a Black Angus beef at night, and you'd see a game department truck out the next day hauling off the remains before the road was full of grizzlies looking for an easy meal. Crandall's ranchers were used to losing calves to grizzlies, not to mention mountain lions and coyotes. When you ran cattle on national forest land, or adjacent to it, it was just the cost of doing business. But now they were dealing with wolves as well. Dispersing Yellowstone wolves had established a resident pack in Crandall by 1999, and though they mostly preyed on the area's abundant elk, from time to time they killed a calf or a cow. Unlike Louis and his fellow guides, however, the ranchers could do something about it. For decades, cattlemen with leases in Greater Yellowstone had relied on Animal Damage Control, a federal agency that employs professional trappers and hunters in every western state to remove problem wildlife. The agency, a division of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, kills tens of thousands of predators annually, mostly coyotes, but also bobcats, mountain lions, black bears, foxes, and red-tailed hawks, among others, to protect cattle and sheep grazing on both public and private lands. Once wolves were returned to the northern Rockies, the pressure on the agency to begin killing them was almost immediate. Shortly after reintroduction, the owner of a ranch known as the Diamond G filed suit against U.S. Fish and Wildlife citing cattle losses on the 70,000 acres his stock grazed in the Du Noir Valley, a remote drainage deep in the Shoshone National Forest, about 30 miles south of Crandall. The ranch managers, John and Debbie Robinette, told reporters wolves first began appearing on the ranch about a year after they were returned to Yellowstone. Like every other rancher in Wyoming, at least those under the age of 80 or so, they had no experience with wolves. That spring they lost 61 calves. It was difficult to say how many of those had been killed by wolves and how many were taken by other predators. Nevertheless, a pro-wolf group called Defenders of Wildlife, determined to establish goodwill for the reintroduction program, compensated the ranch for the calves from a private fund raised solely for that purpose. The money helped offset the increased losses, but life on the ranch never felt the same. One night, as Debbie was taking her Great Pyrenees, Booger, from the ranch house out to his bed in the barn, a group of wolves appeared out of nowhere. They showed no interest in her, but several of them immediately attacked the dog. Debbie ran to her jeep, jumped in and flashed the lights and honked the horn. The wolves disappeared, driven off by the commotion. She found Booger the next day, miraculously alive, though covered with bite wounds. "It's very personal to me," Debbie told the Associated Press, speaking of wolves. "I want them eliminated." Wolves might have been a novel sight on the Diamond G in the 1990s, but the contest Debbie described, dog and shepherd versus wolf with livestock as the stakes, was as timeless as any in recorded history. Wolves were once the most widely distributed land mammal on Earth, and every pastoral civilization in the Northern Hemisphere outside of Africa competed with them for land on which to run livestock, and for the livestock themselves. Wolves very rarely attacked people, but a single wolf could ruin a shepherd's livelihood if he developed a taste for cattle, sheep, or goats. For centuries, wolves dominated rural conversation as the weather does today, a legacy reflected in the dozens of wolf metaphors that still color languages around the world, in most cases, long after any living memory of seeing a wolf on the landscape remains. Everywhere human civilization flourished, wolves were routed, until Homo sapiens, not Canis lupus, became the most widely spread species. Ironically, the dog, a domesticated wolf, became the first line of defense against depredating wolves, which grew more common as wild prey populations declined under pressure from human hunting and loss of habitat. Romans sometimes referred to dawn as inter lupum et canum, between the wolf and the dog. Dogs ruled the day, and wolves owned the night. Humanity's most beloved animal and its most despised were essentially the same creature, but the wolf's threat to the shepherd's livelihood poisoned relations between men and wolves, and the wolf's reputation never recovered. In Western culture, the wolf became an embodiment of wickedness. From the Middle Ages, when the werewolf myth first appeared, to Grimm's fairy tales in the early 19th century. Early Christians, the flock, as believers were called, saw themselves represented in the sheep. Their shepherd was God. The wolf that preyed upon the flock was the devil himself. And now the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had brought the devil back to the Northern Rockies. The wolves frequenting the Diamond G weren't eliminated, but animal damage control, in keeping with the bargain made with ranchers prior to reintroduction, shot several of them. In the years that followed, Fish and Wildlife received a steady stream of complaints from ranchers, especially as wolves expanded their territory even further. Losses in Crandall had been minor, though the numbers were trending in the wrong direction as far as the local ranchers were concerned. They didn't relish learning how to deal with a predator their own ancestors had so decisively defeated long ago. Even before the return of wolves, Crandall had the feel of a world apart, a place that modernity had passed by. Turnbull had never used Google, never sent an email. He was, as he put it, computer illiterate. His cabin had no landline, and he was too far from the nearest tower to have much luck receiving calls on his cell phone either, even with a signal booster and a rooftop antenna. He'd never been to a big city. Wyoming, with a total population under 600,000, didn't have any, and rarely ever encountered anyone who didn't look like him. He liked to tell people from out of town that he'd seen far more grizzlies in his life than he had ethnic or racial minorities. But even Crandall was changing. For the last 30 years at least, ever since A River Runs Through It was published, people all over the country had been buying vacation homes in the mountains around Yellowstone, looking to secure their own little piece of heaven. Or not so little. Entire ranches were snapped up, sometimes at outrageous prices. Other times, large spreads were subdivided into ranchettes. High prices accelerated the trend. The more valuable the land became, the less likely the large ranches were to pass intact from one generation to the next. Estate taxes, along with the tremendous incentive to sell, took their toll. The new owners usually kept a few cattle so they could also keep the generous tax exemption bestowed upon agricultural land, but few of them had any real interest in ranching. Most of the big ranches in Crandall and Sunlight were still held by traditional cattlemen, unlike the river valleys farther south, such as the prestigious South Fork of the Shoshone, where a 500-acre section of Buffalo Bill's Dude Ranch, once hunted by Teddy Roosevelt, among other early 20th-century celebrities and swells, sold for $3.8 million. But Crandall and Sunlight both had their share of new million-dollar houses owned by vanity ranchers who didn't know an Angus from a Holstein or a mule deer from an elk. There was the billionaire who cleared a piece of meadow long enough to land a Learjet near his vacation house, for example. Turnbull hadn't even known such a thing was possible. Then there was the private equity fund manager who bought the Switchback Ranch, an 8,200-acre spread situated high above the Sunlight Basin, on a bench so isolated that it could be reached only by a rugged trail barely manageable by an ATV. The new owner didn't seem to mind. He came and went by helicopter, as did all his supplies. Every spring, he ferried thousands of pounds of freight, diesel, food, seed to feed the cattle he ran, over the river from a knoll near the highway. Turnbull couldn't even begin to guess what that might cost. He'd heard some grumbling about the site of his cabin, which was not the most beautiful structure in Crandall, ruining someone's perfect view of paradise, but he couldn't care less what they thought. As long as he could still get an elk, he wasn't going anywhere. For outfitters like Louis, fewer working ranches meant good horses were getting harder to find. Ranch owners traditionally sold off their horses when they reached the age of 6 or 7 years to force their cowboys to switch to younger animals that needed gentling. That provided local outfitters with a steady stream of horses available for purchase that were calm and predictable, perfect for inexperienced riders. Now there just weren't as many for sale. Louis and his son Casey found themselves holding on to the stock they had for longer and longer, which meant spending more time and money caring for horses with bad knees. Even so, they were increasingly forced to head up the mountain with young and inexperienced horses, which raised the chances of an accident. Panicked horses had been known to throw riders off the side of the mountain or to fall to their deaths themselves. On one of Casey's final trips up the mountain, he guided a pair of clients on an archery elk hunt. One of them shot a bull, and Casey began to dress him. It was late in the day, and the temperature was dropping. The hunters mounted up to head back to camp, but the smell of fresh blood spooked one of the young horses, and it began galloping down the trail with the client on its back. "Bail out!" Casey yelled at the man. The client had the presence of mind to leap to the ground before the horse had gone too far, but he fell awkwardly, and the quiver of arrows on his shoulder wound up beneath him as he landed. When he rolled over, Casey saw a broken arrow shaft sticking out of the man's thigh, its razor-sharp head buried deep in the muscle. They were 5 miles from camp, and another 5 from the nearest road. The client pulled the arrow out himself, but he was bleeding badly and couldn't ride. Casey put a tourniquet on the wound, built a fire for the 2 men, and raced back down the trail on his own horse to get sleeping bags and food in case the injured man had to spend the night where he lay. When he got within range, he called his mother, who was in camp cooking dinner, on his 2-way radio. She found a satellite phone in the client's gear and walked out into a clearing to call the hospital in Cody, which sent a helicopter. Afraid the injured client would sue, Casey didn't charge either man for the hunt. Not long afterward, Casey told his dad he'd had enough. For the amount of money the outfitting business was bringing in, the hassle just wasn't worth it. The Forest Service bureaucracy, the insurance companies, the cattlemen, and now the wolves, it was too much. The family still had the guest ranch, which brought in some revenue, but Shelley and Louie didn't really need Casey to help run it, and he wasn't the type to freeload. He decided to try farming instead. Louis helped set him up on a piece of land the family owned near Powell, Wyoming, about 100 miles east, out in the arid Bighorn Basin, and Casey, his wife, and their young daughter moved away for good. It had been a couple of years since they'd left. Now his life was about seed and diesel and irrigation pipe. Once, alone in the Crandall backcountry,